loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, President Trump and his advisors are pushing ahead with his theory that he can revoke birthright citizenship by signing an executive order. Most Republican leaders and constitutional scholars have condemned the president's position on the basis that it violates the 14th Amendment, but the issue will likely have to be settled in the courts. Next, an Israeli airstrike killed three young Palestinian boys on Sunday evening near the fence that separates Israel from Gaza. Israeli authorities said that one of the aircraft rocketed the boys, two aged 13 and one 14, while they were planting explosives. Palestinian authorities, however, said that was nonsense. Then, New Zealand's government said today that a landmark 11-country trade deal that would slash tariffs and increase trade will come into effect at the end of December after being ratified by New Zealand, Australia, Canada, Japan, Mexico, and Singapore. The Trump administration withdrew from the Pacific Rim Trade Pact early last year to, in President Trump's words, prioritize protecting American jobs. And then Chabahar is an Iranian port on the Indian Ocean, Iran's only direct access to open ocean. The port was built and developed by Indian companies working with the government of India to expand that country's ability to trade with the rest of the world, but especially with Afghanistan. The idea was a good one for virtually all of the economies in the area, but now U.S. sanctions on Iran threaten the port's viability. And finally, the Cook Political Report, arguably the most highly respected political analysis outlet in the country, reported today that Democrats may be on the brink of a major sweep of governor's mansions in every Great Lakes state with an election this year. Democratic gains would have lasting importance because of the upcoming 2020 census and the resultant mandate to draw new congressional district borders. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. And now we turn to the issue of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. President Trump and his advisors are pushing ahead with his theory that he can revoke birthright citizenship by signing an executive order. Most Republican leaders and constitutional scholars have condemned the president's position on the basis that it violates the 14th Amendment, but the issue will likely have to be settled in the courts. We're joined from Portland, Oregon by David Gespass. He is the former president of the National Lawyers Guild. David, welcome to the show.
Glad to be on.
David, you know, you watch the news over the last 24 or 48 hours, and I think I haven't seen a single person take this seriously. Except for the president. And then the president said again this morning that he is going to sign this executive order maybe in the coming days and just let the courts hash it out. How does this play out?
Well, I also recall that Mike Pence argued that this is appropriate.
Yes.
Yes, that's true.
Yes.
It does play out, I suppose. He signs the order. Somebody files suit claiming that it's a violation of the Constitution and that presumably works its way up through the courts, potentially to the Supreme Court if the Supreme Court decides to grant certiorari on it. My expectation would be that in the district court level, that's the first level, it would be held unconstitutional. But quite frankly, I am not as sanguine as most about what would happen on the Supreme Court level.
Really? Can you explain that for us?
Yes, sure. I just do not think that any of us should underestimate the capacity for sophistry that the majority of the Supreme Court has, and in particular that the Federalist Society has. And I would note, by the way, I was just doing a little bit of research on it, the Heritage Foundation has already published something entitled Birthright Citizenship, A Fundamental Misunderstanding of the 14th Amendment, in which it claims that being subject to the jurisdiction of the United States doesn't mean being subject to its laws and penalties. It means that you have submitted yourself to the authority of the sovereign.
So let's help the lay audience understand what that means. What are they actually saying?
Okay. Well, the 14th Amendment says that anyone who is born in the United States and subject to its jurisdiction is a citizen. And that has been interpreted at one point by the Supreme Court to say that that excludes children of diplomats and ministers and things like that who remain subject to the jurisdiction of the country and are protected by diplomatic immunity.
That makes sense.
And there is a case called U.S. v. Wong Kim Ark, which was a Chinese born in the United States who traveled to China and then came back and was excluded under the Chinese Exclusion Act. And he sued, and despite the fact that the federal government opposed it, he won.
That was a case from, I think, 1898.
Yes, I think so. And nothing's been really questioned since then. But his parents were actually conducting business in the United States, back then I don't think they had quite the same issues as we do now about resident aliens and whatnot. So nothing's really been questioned about that. But now that this has come up, at least the Heritage Foundation has come up with this theory that applies only for people who have green cards and their children, and not for undocumented immigrants. And I think that's the distinction on which the president is basing his claim, if in fact this president ever has any intellectual or theoretical basis for anything he has to say. But there is at least that from the Heritage Foundation, and there is, from my very brief reading of this Wong Kim Ark case, I think there is at least a little bit of wiggle room in terms of what that case actually means. Although it would seem clear that if you are subject to being prosecuted for criminal acts, if you're subject to being arrested, if you're subject to all those things, you're subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. But that really is the issue, I think. And I think that is what the president would hang his hat on, or at least his advisors. You know, my feeling is that the only reason he's saying this is to sort of, you know, agitate his base in advance of the election next week.
David Gespass is our guest. He's the former president of the National Lawyers Guild. He's an attorney, obviously. He lives in Alabama, but right now he's at the National Lawyers Guild convention in Portland, Oregon. David Gespass, the 14th Amendment was adopted in 1868. And as I understand it, what the purpose of this amendment to the Constitution was to make it illegal to have two different classes of people who were born in the United States. One class of people were free people, and they were citizens. And then there was another class of people who were born in chains, who were born enslaved by other parts of the population. And those people were not, before the 14th Amendment, considered human beings with citizenship rights. They were considered property. So what the 14th Amendment does, essentially, is it gets rid of the idea that there are, at least in a legal sense, two classes in the United States, free people and enslaved people, free people and property, that all people born here are thus citizens. And that's, in fact, really what's at stake when Donald Trump says we're going to get rid of the 14th Amendment.
I think that's fair. The 14th Amendment, and that particular provision was specifically to overrule the Dred Scott opinion, which said that black people have no rights that the white man is due to respect. And it's an interesting thing because the Federalist Society, we hear about strict constructionism and original intent for the Constitution, and relying on the meaning of the words. The meaning of those words are clear. What the 14th Amendment says isn't really beyond cavil. And I think that the so-called strict constructionists and originalists on the Supreme Court are now faced with having to justify, if they want to uphold an executive order, they are forced with having to justify that, in fact, those words don't mean what they say. And all I'm saying is that I don't think it's beyond question that they won't find a way to do that. I'm not saying that they're going to do it, but I'm just saying that I'm not as sanguine as a lot of people that they won't.
And just for our audience, sanguine meaning you're not as calm, you're not as comforted by the idea that the Supreme Court will ultimately undo Donald Trump's executive order, meaning that the Supreme Court has been stacked, really, by right-wing with right-wing judges by the Federalist Society, as it's been stacking courts around the country, and that under those political circumstances, some of these right-wing political operatives who are now begowned sort of legal, I don't know what the right word is, the deciders, like Brett Kavanaugh, for instance, who was a Federalist Society, groomed by the Federalist Society, that they could, in fact, in spite of all of existing precedent on the Fourth Amendment, turn it around. That's what you mean by not sanguine.
Exactly, yes. I look at Bush v. Gore, for instance, in which they just, all these so-called originalists just invented a theory and applied it only to that one case. So I just don't think it's beyond question that they are unable to invent a theory and apply it to this executive order if it is in fact signed.
Very, very interesting. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I was just going to say, let's say that the president goes forward with this, that enough members of the judiciary take it seriously, and it does make its way to the Supreme Court. Is this going to be somehow fast-tracked, or is it going to just grind through the courts over a period of years like any other court case would?
That's an interesting question. I don't have a good answer for that. It may well be fast-tracked to some extent. That's pretty much up to the court. You know, it's up to the Supreme Court how quickly it wants to hear something, or if it wants to hear it. You know, as I said, the Supreme Court can choose to hear or not hear this particular appeal, although if it's an executive order, they likely will. But the Pentagon Papers case, for instance, that went up very, very quickly, and it is likely that this would, but one can never be sure.
Yeah. Well, we're probably going to have to leave it there. I wish we could talk about this a little longer, but we were joined from Portland, Oregon by David Gespass. David is the former president of the National Lawyers Guild. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
An Israeli airstrike killed three young Palestinian boys on Sunday evening near the fence that separates Israel from Gaza. Israeli authorities say that one of their aircraft rocketed the boys, two aged 13 and one 14, while they were planting explosives. Palestinian authorities, however, say that that was nonsense and that the boys were engaged in a peaceful protest. We're joined from Washington by Dan Cohen. He's a journalist and a documentary filmmaker with extensive experience in the Middle East. His latest film is Killing Gaza.
Good to be with you guys.
Dan, there's a lot more to this story. This isn't just the Israelis killing more children. I mean, that kind of, it's awful to say, but it happens all the time. This is not just an extension of the war, the Israeli war against Gaza, but there are other aspects to it. One of the most important being water. Another one being electricity. It's not just an issue of rocketing civilians in Gaza. It's an issue of squeezing the Palestinians in Gaza until they just can't continue to survive. Go ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, Israel's war on Gaza is in all aspects. It's not only, you know, shooting protesters on the border, shooting unarmed protesters in the border en masse. It's not only having drone strikes on children. It's an all-out economic warfare. It's siege. It's in every way possible. So, you know, we see it playing out in a number of ways, whereas these three boys, two of which are 13 and one are 14, they're young boys, were targeted apparently by a drone strike. So essentially they present no threat to Israel and they were just killed. And it doesn't even really register in Western media. I mean, we can only imagine the outrage we'd be seeing if it were the other way around. If Palestinians had killed three Israeli boys, I mean, it would be, you know, we would see condemnations from Donald Trump and Mike Pence and we'd see the West up in arms, but it doesn't even make a blip on the radar when Palestinians are killed by Israel. And as you said, there's also this horrific issue of dirty water, of refuse, that is now creating disease in the Gaza Strip. And that goes back to a long-term policy of Israel's de-development. And back in 2014, during the 51-day war on Gaza, Israel directly targeted the sewage treatment plants, and so those do not work. I actually visited those, and, you know, there's no reason, there's no military use for these things. It's simply just to make sure that Gaza doesn't, that they're not able to treat their sewage. And so it gets so bad that you actually have children dying from swimming in the sea where the raw sewage is pumped out in massive amounts. When I was living in Gaza, I was in this hotel and it was on the beach and it was this beautiful, you know, world-class beach, but they're just, because they're not allowed to treat their sewage, the sewage just pumps out into the Mediterranean Sea. And if, you know, if you go swim anywhere, you're basically bound to get raw sewage on you. That's what happens. And it's just created another health crisis that, because Palestinians in Gaza are living under this brutal decade-long siege, they don't have any way to deal with.
Dan Cohen, let me ask you, do you think the Israeli population, the Jewish population in Israel, do they know this?
Yes, actually, you know, this came into Israeli consciousness about a year ago, because this the sewage problem got so bad that it was actually drifting, the sewage in the sea was drifting up towards beaches, or, you know, around like Tel Aviv. And so it, you know, it's, I guess it's like a form of a blowback of sewage. And so it became like a problem for Israelis. And so, you know, there was talk about, oh, maybe we should do something. Maybe we should allow them to rebuild their sewage plants. And so it's not like as if, you know, it's some big secret that Gaza is in a complete crisis and it's a disaster, and it has been for years and years. It's just, you know, almost no one cares in Israel. It's just, or they support it and see it as a way to, you know, achieve their goals. But basically the idea is to make life so unbearable in the Gaza Strip that people just flee. But of course, they can't flee at this point. There's, you know, there's nowhere to go.
Yeah, nowhere to go.
So this is the big contradiction, because on one hand, Israel covets that land of the, you know, the Gaza Strip, wants that land. But on the other hand, it doesn't have anywhere to send them. You know, Europe certainly doesn't want more refugees, and it's not, they can't just send them into the Sinai Desert in Egypt. So that's the contradiction, and how it plays out, it's just, well, lock 2 million Palestinians in a prison and keep them under, you know, these horrible conditions, and maybe at some point then, you know, Israel will find a way to expel them. They've talked about expelling them into the Sinai Desert, you know, which is part of Egypt, but that's not really a political reality that can happen right now. So for the time being, just keep them in Gaza.
Dan, is there any realistic outcome to this? Because as you point out, I mean, Gaza is one of the most densely populated places on the planet. You can't just expel people. You can't just force them into the Sinai Desert where there's no water, there's no food, there's no shelter, there's nowhere to go, there's nowhere to settle. What exactly is the Israeli endgame here, other than to just sort of encircle Gaza and enslave the place?
Well, that's the thing. I don't think there is. Israel doesn't really have an endgame. It's just permanent apartheid, permanent occupation. And with the Gaza Strip specifically, it's, you know, in the words of the Israelis, preventing a humanitarian collapse that, in their words, will end up exploding in our face. And so we just saw Israel negotiate with Hamas through Qatar to transfer apparently $15 million a month to keep the Gaza Strip from total collapse. Because at that point, then you have, not only do you have, you know, mass protests on the border, then you just have the most basic services are just non-existent. So it goes from, you know, 4 hours of electricity a day, which is, you know, unbearable, and would be it's just an everyday crisis that no one in this country or in Israel would ever tolerate. And then you go from that to zero. And so Israel knows that that can't happen. And so it's, you know, Israel always says, we can't negotiate with Hamas. You know, you can't negotiate with terrorists. But it shows that Israel is constantly negotiating with Hamas, just through back channels, through an intermediary. And so the idea is to keep Gaza hovering above complete 100% destruction, but also to punish it severely for any form of resistance, or even if you don't resist, you know, basically you just are forced to live in these horrific conditions. So there is no Israeli endgame. What we're seeing is Israel's endgame.
So it's just a form of perpetual cruelty, actually. You know, the thing about it is that I want to go back to the Israeli population because it's hard for me to believe, Dan, that some part, even with the very strong right wing drift in Israel and the acceptance of racism, there must be some part of the population that considers this to be completely gross, which doesn't mean that they're anti-Zionist or anything like that, but just such extreme racism. In every apartheid state, there's part of the oppressor population, the oppressor nation, so to speak, that's just mortified and turns against it, or at least is repelled and does something.
Yes. I think there's two components to that. In the kind of liberal Tel Aviv bubble of Israel, there are people who will say, you know, there were anti-war demonstrations. They're not saying lift the siege, let the refugees come home, let's live in a democracy. But they're saying, they couch it in, well, you know, the children in Sderot, which is an Israeli city near the Gaza border, they want to live in peace just like the Palestinian children do. And, you know, so like we shouldn't bomb each other, but we should just, they should stay on their side and we should stay on our side. And that's the best you're going to get. And that's probably a minority of Israeli society, what you're describing. But this tiny fringe of anti-Zionists who really want, who understand that the core of the problem is this demographically engineered so-called Jewish state that requires a majority of Jews to live in a place where they are not a majority. And so, you know, requires this massive violence in what we see in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, and requires, you know, the continued expulsion of Palestinians in the surrounding countries. They understand that that's the basic, you know, problem and contradiction. And so they, you know, there are these videos on Facebook by a journalist named Chaim Schwarzenberg of these guys, of about a dozen Israelis, maybe 20 Jewish Israelis, going to the Gaza border and protesting from, you know, the Israeli side and waving Palestinian flags and actually talking on the phone. And they're some of the most inspiring videos I've seen in a long time. You know, there's one video where they're playing drums on one side and the Palestinians about, you know, 500 meters away or maybe 300 meters away are dancing. And so this is the tiny, tiny portion of the Israeli population that truly believes in real peace, in real justice, and in real democracy for all of the people in, you know, between the river and the sea.
We will leave it there. That was the voice of Dan Cohen, who joined us from Washington. Dan's a journalist and a documentary filmmaker whose latest film is Killing Gaza. He has extensive experience in the Middle East and especially in Gaza. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The New Zealand government said today that a landmark 11-country trade deal that would slash tariffs and increase trade will come into effect at the end of December after being ratified by New Zealand, Australia, Canada, Japan, Mexico, and Singapore. The Trump administration withdrew from the Pacific Rim Trade Pact early last year to, in President Trump's words, prioritize protecting American jobs. We're joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. You can check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com. Jack, welcome back.
My pleasure to be here.
Jack, tell me off the bat, have we missed a historic opportunity here by withdrawing from this trade deal before it was even finally negotiated?
When Trump came into office, one of his first acts was to refuse to sign the TPP deal, which was already dead in Congress already. Trump's trade policy has been to renegotiate these multilateral free trade deals on a bilateral country-to-country basis. Trump is a free trader. He just wants to be a bilateral free trader. And he's done this, of course, with bilateral deal renegotiations with South Korea and then with Mexico and Canada, and he'll do that with Europe once Brexit is cleared over there. And as far as TPP and this agreement that you just referenced, so Japan is playing the proxy for the U.S. since the U.S. pulled out of the TPP, meaning Japan has been the lead negotiating country to pull together the remainder of the TPP countries. And now there is a multilateral TPP without the U.S. Now, the U.S., I think, will come in the back door. Once it renegotiates its bilateral deal with Japan, that will be a template for the U.S. to simply reapply to the other 12 nations that are now part of the TPP. So you will get a TPP-like terms and conditions for the U.S., but it will be on a country-by-country basis.
So is there any way for the United States to gain any sort of benefit from this if it's not an active member and an active participant, or have we just gone the wrong way?
Well, we haven't gone the wrong way as far as not participating in multilateral free trade deals. You know, the reason why Trump doesn't like multilateral free trade is because the U.S. Doesn't have as much bargaining power to pull off the best deal for U.S. multinational corporations. That's why he's turned to bilateral. And of course, it has something to do where he thinks he's a great negotiator and he can get a better deal. But, you know, this turn from multilateral free trade to bilateral free trade is just really to improve the conditions for U.S. corporations. You see, we got a slowdown in global trade everywhere, and we have a fight over a shrinking global trade pie between the different sectors of the global capitalist economy. And the U.S. is renegotiating these free trade deals in order to ensure and even advance its share of this shrinking pie. That's how you got to see all this trade offensive that's going on.
Jack, let me jump in. That said, the U.S., by having bilateral negotiations, and again, for our audience that may not be familiar with this language, that means bilateral means the U.S. has direct trade agreements with Canada, say, or Japan, or Korea, or whatever other country. The two countries bilaterally agree to the terms of trade, rather than a multilateral agreement where the United States' particular economic power, which is greater for most instances than any other particular party, gets somewhat diluted because it then has to come to a consensus and worry about what's good for all rather than just simply what's good for the U.S. or what's good within that bilateral relationship. What the U.S. gains under the Trump strategy is more pull and power and impact on any particular bilateral negotiation. But what it gives up by pursuing this strategy is the concept of being the global leader of the world economy, meaning it keeps friends and foe sort of under its wing as a consequence of multilateral agreements. Does that pose a shift, a change from the post-World War II multilateral order that the United States itself constructed during those years, 1943 to 1946?
Yes, to some extent it does. The U.S. Strategy had been under Reagan to negotiate these multilateral deals ever since then. But the U.S. now, as the global economy is becoming more unstable and fragile, and global trade now is slowing down, and we see these problems emerging because of excess debt and financial instability everywhere, the U.S. now feels that it can negotiate a better deal for itself on a one-by-one approach. So it's willing to use the tactic of unilateral negotiations to benefit and strengthen the U.S. position rather than multilateral. In the past, when the system was more stable, multilateralism served a purpose. But with the system being more unstable, it's turning to case-by-case negotiations. Europe is more, for example, and emerging markets don't have as strong bargaining position as they used to be. So it's to the U.S.'s advantage to negotiate on a one-by-one basis.
And again, let's say Trump is no longer president. He doesn't win in 2020, or maybe by 2024, if he does win a second term. Does this constitute a sea change in American posture in terms of global trade, or is this Donald Trump?
Well, I think to a large extent it's Donald Trump. If Donald Trump loses the election in 2020, you will see a shift back to what he calls globalism, The wing of the U.S. elites here that are in conflict with the Trump wing. It's an internecine conflict that's going on between these two wings as far as what policies are best for U.S. Capitalism. You know, they will prevail, and I predict they will attempt to restore some of the multilateral approach. If his approach succeeds, in other words, it delivers even better returns for U.S. corporations, then, it will have proven itself, you will not see that kind of a shift back.
How long will it take us as a country to figure out which route was the best?
Well, the best for whom is the question, you see.
Right, sure.
Yeah, what's best for U.S. corporations is not necessarily best for U.S. Consumers and workers.
Indeed.
You know, if you're saying what's best for them, so far Trump has been a lot better than Obama because he's really delivered the big tax cuts. He's delivered the increase in defense spending. He's now beating up on foreign competitors with his trade offensive. The stock markets have increased, significantly under Trump. They were sort of leveling off the stock and bond markets. So he's delivering for them. There's no doubt. And they love him. We'll see whether the recession in 2019-20 undermines that whole idea of having delivered for them. It could very well. And that will be the big decider whether 2020 Trump gets another shot to extend 4 years or not.
That's Jack Rasmus. Jack Rasmus, interesting point. You think the big sectors of the capitalist class, meaning property owners, bankers, corporations, at this moment, they are pleased with Donald Trump.
Yes, absolutely. They're pleased with Trump because they felt that Obama could not really resurrect the Reagan, post-Reagan strategy change, which is sometimes called neoliberalism, you see. And it kind of neoliberalism hit a wall in 2008 with the crisis. Obama could not really restore it fully. And that's what generated the certain wing of the capitalist class betting on Trump here. And he predicted he would be able to restore it. He would get the tax cuts. He would go after the foreign competitors. And so far, he has done that successfully.
Okay, we can leave it right there. That was the voice of Dr. Jack Rasmus, who joined us from California. Dr. Rasmus is a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California, and he's the author of the book Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. Check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Chabahar is an Iranian port on the Indian Ocean and is Iran's only direct access to open ocean. The port was built and developed by Indian companies working with the government of India to expand that country's ability to trade with the rest of the world, but especially to trade with Afghanistan. The idea was a good one for virtually all of the economies in the area, but now U.S. sanctions on Iran threaten the port's viability. We're joined from Massachusetts by Vijay Prashad. He's the director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research and chief editor of Leftward Books. He is also the author, most recently, of The Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution and of Red Star Over the Third World. Welcome back, Vijay.
Nice to be with you.
Vijay, I would venture to say that 99.5% of Americans have never heard of Chabahar, but this is a major economic development in Southwest Asia. Can you tell us really what it is and what its purpose is?
Well, its purpose is different for each of the three players who are involved, that is India, Iran, and Afghanistan. Afghanistan, as you know, is a landlocked country, and it largely relies on Pakistan to get its goods to market and to bring fuel into the country. It has also partly relied on China, with which it shares not a border, but countries such as Uzbekistan and so on that allow goods to be transshipped. It has recently, that is in the last 10 to 15 years, increased its trade with Iran. And I think this is really interesting. during the time of quite serious U.S. sanctions against Iran, Afghanistan was nonetheless buying oil from Iran. And in fact, as the United States' own officials discovered, the U.S. military was using Iranian oil, which was far cheaper than either flying in oil into Kabul or bringing oil through Pakistan. So Afghanistan has been desperate for some means to, you know, get access to the ocean and not rely entirely upon Pakistan. So that was its agenda here, to find a new way to get to the open water. India is very eager to get access to raw materials from Afghanistan, as well as to find a new route into Central Asia and Russian markets. You know, this has been a very long-standing problem for India. It has no easy way to send goods into the Russian market and to Central Asia. And Iran, of course, has looked for a very long time to deepen its regional partners, so that when it gets isolated by the United States, the isolation attempted by the United States is made complicated, as it is now, by these regional entanglements.
Vijay Prashad is our guest. Vijay, the Indian government, which has a friendly relationship, the Modi government is a friendly relationship with Trump, is asking the Trump administration for a waiver on sanctions, the Iran sanctions, so that this port, which is just becoming operational, can actually do what it was intended to do. That creates a conflict within the Trump administration. And it may also create a conflict between the White House, which has its own agenda regarding Iran, because it's under the leadership of Bolton and Pompeo and those, you know, who have made a career out of smashing or crushing or demonizing or caricaturing Iran. And on the other hand, you have the Pentagon. And the Pentagon, of course, has the issue of Afghanistan first and foremost in terms of its own military priorities. So, yes, the Afghan government, which is the ally of the United States government, needs the oil from Iran. And also, in terms of how a post-war, or even not post-war, but an Afghan reconstruction takes place, will it take place under the sort of sponsorship of India or under the sponsorship of Pakistan? And of course, the Pentagon sees Pakistan's government as connected to the Taliban, or at least its intelligence services. So is there a room here, or is there already existing a debate, a schism within the U.S. government over what to do with this port?
Well, in a sense, the United States government is like a human being who's put its hand inside a bee's nest and is unable to extricate it, you know, constantly getting bitten over the last 17 years around the question of what to do about Afghanistan. There has been no clarity, no strategic clarity over Afghanistan and the U.S. war there. And indeed, this is demonstrated by the fact that the United States has decided to once again isolate Iran, which had played a very important stabilizing role in parts of particularly Western Afghanistan, Eastern Afghanistan. You know, the idea that the United States, you know, is going to look at this, whether from the Pentagon side or the White House side, rationally, I think should be set aside. I think even the Pentagon has not been, bold in its understanding that this war in Afghanistan is an utter failure, and that Iran has to play a very important stabilizing role alongside, I think, not a choice between India or China, but alongside India, China, and Pakistan. All four of these regional countries have to play a role in the stabilization of Afghanistan. I think there is an appetite in the new Pakistani government for something like this. I think that if the Indian government is shown the road, it might accept that there is a way for India, Pakistan, Iran, and China to stabilize Afghanistan. You know, you've got to understand that India has a very large, you know, a stake in an iron ore mine in Afghanistan. This is a very important raw material for the Indian economy, for Indian big business. And Indian big business has been putting pressure on Delhi to make some kind of deal with the United States to get this port out of the sanctions register and to bring some stability in Afghanistan. You know, business doesn't always like war, even though war is extremely good for business.
Historically, the Indians have had very close relations with the Afghans, and the Afghans generally distrust and dislike the Pakistanis, even though in many cases they're related to them. I mean, literally related to them familially. But this port, Vijay, as you said a second ago, is a good economic idea for everybody in the region, for stability in the region, for peace in the region. What happens then if the Trump administration refuses to grant a waiver? What happens when the port itself is then subject to sanctions? Do the Indians and the Afghans just decide they're going to ignore American sanctions?
Well, you know, it's not just this port. I mean, the Chabahar port plays a very important role in India's strategic interests. And it should be said that there is an element of, you know, minor power jostling here as well, because the Chinese and the Pakistanis have developed the port at Gwadar, which is just down the road from Chabahar, another port which would link Afghanistan to the Indian Ocean, but of course through Balochistan, an area again of instability. But it's not just this port, it's also oil. And it's again not just India, it's China, it's Japan, Sri Lanka. I mean, countries in the Indian Ocean and in the South China Sea rely on Iranian oil, and they're unwilling to pivot. And each of these countries are looking, and they've even spoken of creating an alternative banking system. I think it's important to recognize that the U.S. government cannot prevent people from buying Iranian oil. That's not sanctioned. What's sanctioned is the ability to pay for it. In other words, the use of American-dominated banking systems and of the SWIFT network, the wire service, which is based in Belgium. I mean, that's the problem. The problem isn't getting the oil to your country. It's how do you pay for it? So these countries, including Japan, have been openly talking about an alternative banking system. It seems to me that when the Trump administration puts these new sanctions in place in November, it's going to find that very large parts of Asia and even the European Union is not willing to go along with the sanctions, and they're looking for ways to go around them. So I'm afraid these sanctions, which are very tough in the letter, might end up being a damp squib for the Trump administration.
Vijay Prashad is our guest. Vijay is the director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research and chief editor of Leftward Books. He's the author of many books, most recently The Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution and Red Star Over the Third World. Vijay, we have about 90 seconds left, a little bit under 2 minutes, actually. When we're looking forward, we have a situation where these countries that are neighbors but have in the past had conflicts, at least conflicts between their elites, which has led to nationalistic conflicts, they have the potential of banding together, of being a bloc that makes sense economically. At the same time, you have the sort of never-ending pressure from the United States, the U.S. empire, its ability to control world finance, as you're mentioning. Is there a way out, or do you think there's a will for a way out, given the nature of the political government in, say, India or in Pakistan?
I think that now that you have a far-right government in Brazil, where the new incoming president has said he might withdraw from the BRICS bloc, if the BRICS bloc goes its own way, you have, as it is, Russia and China that are developing a very close relationship. Countries like India are going to be left in the cold. I mean, they're going to have to decide, do they want to be subordinate allies of the United States, or do they want to have some sort of regional framework by which they can improve the situation of their own economy, whether it's just the elites or even the middle class. So I think with the destruction of the BRICS bloc, which is imminent, I think India is going to have to seriously consider its regional landscape. And that's going to mean coming to terms with the overture from Pakistan, because the new prime minister has indeed made an overture to the Indian government. So really, it's to be seen what's going to happen in that front.
Very interesting. That was the voice of Vijay Prashad. We were talking to Vijay from Massachusetts. He is the director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. He is the chief editor of Leftward Books. He's a prolific author. most recently of the death of the nation and the future of the Arab Revolution, and Red Star over the Third World. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. The Cook Political Report, arguably the most highly respected political analysis outlet in the country, reported today that Democrats may be on the brink of a major sweep of governor's mansions in every Great Lakes state with an election this year. Democratic gains would have lasting importance because of the upcoming 2020 census and the resultant mandate to draw new congressional district boundaries. We're joined from Detroit by Julie Hurwitz. She is a civil rights attorney and partner at the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James. Julie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Julie, most Americans, I think, haven't paid very close attention to these Great Lakes governor's races. People have been so focused on states like Florida and Georgia that have these monumental races where candidates are spending tens of millions of dollars apiece, and the polls have them, you know, pretty much 50-50. And then there are these races around the Great Lakes, and I'm talking specifically of Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Illinois, and Minnesota. And the Democrats are looking pretty strong right now. Let's start with Michigan and Wisconsin. What can you tell us about those?
Well, I know most about Michigan, but I've done a little bit of research on what's going on in Wisconsin as well. And I can say that both of the Republican candidates in both Michigan and Wisconsin are somewhat interchangeable with one another. They're staunch right-wingers. They're anti-worker. They're anti-union. They're blatantly dishonest. They're opportunistic at every turn. And I think that in light of the political climate these days, this is starting to come back at them in a way that may truly jeopardize their ability to win these elections. The Democratic gubernatorial candidate here in Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, is a pretty strong Democrat. She's And as is Tony Evers, they're both pretty, from my view of them looking at it, from my vantage point, they're pretty mainstream Democrats, but they're saying the right stuff and they're coming out strongly in support of the rights of working people and the right to health care. And there's a huge focus in both Wisconsin and Michigan on the infrastructure, and both Snyder and Walker have failed miserably during their tenures here in fixing the roads, for example. And, of course, in Michigan, we have the ongoing crisis with the water and the poisoning of the water, and Schutte's smack dab in the middle of that. Interestingly, in Michigan, Governor Snyder, who's term limited, so can't run again, Schutte, who is trying to replace him, has been the attorney general in Michigan for the past 8 years and has used the Flint water crisis in a way that is absolutely outrageous.
You know, I wanted to ask you about that specifically, because if you go on the websites of these candidates, well, much to my surprise, Schutte's website sort of focuses on this amazing job he did relative to the Flint water crisis.
He's an opportunist in the worst possible sense of the term. Not only is that a blatant lie, but as to her credit, Gretchen Whitmer has exposed through some of her campaign ads, while the crisis was actually occurring, while the residents of Flint were actually being poisoned by this water that was filled with lead and other horrible toxins that everybody knew about, and that the alarm bells were going off like crazy between 2013 and 2015, complaints were coming into the Attorney General's office, which were just being completely ignored by Schutte. Then in 2015, when the you-know-what hit the fan, and all of a sudden it became clear that Snyder's administration was smack in the middle of this horrible water poisoning crisis, Snyder and Schutte, although they're in the same party and they're both horrifically terrible people, they hate each other. so what Schuette did was swooped in and started bringing criminal charges against numbers of folks within the Snyder administration to use the Flint simply to further his own political aspirations. These criminal charges that are currently still pending against most of the people, you know, it's an interesting dynamic because on the one hand you think, oh, great, Schuette came in and he did the right thing and he brought criminal charges against those who need to be prosecuted for what happened here. But these criminal cases have been languishing and God only knows whether they're actually going to go forward. The preliminary exams have been spread out over years, and the seriousness with which the Schuette's people, you know, he brought in private, quote-unquote, private people and is paying them millions of dollars to litigate these cases. At the same time, he is spending tens of millions of dollars defending the same people who we are attempting to hold accountable to compensate this community and the people who've been horribly injured. And he is categorically doing everything he can to prevent that from happening. So he can toot his own horn, and that's what he's trying to do. But hopefully the transparency will reveal itself and the responsibility he should be forced to take for perpetuating this horrible situation hopefully will come back to haunt him. But it's a very politically bizarre situation.
The Cook Political Report today is speculating that the Democrats could pick up as many as 9 governor seats, which would make the breakdown across the country 26-24 Democrat, which, you know, the Democrats have not been in a majority in many years in governor's races. But it could be that much of a Democratic year. Illinois is listed as likely Democrat. That's a flip. Michigan is listed as likely Democrat. That's a flip. There are some toss-ups. Ohio is a toss-up. Wisconsin is a toss-up. Now, you mentioned briefly Governor Walker in Wisconsin, probably the single most anti-labor governor in America.
Oh, by far. It's hard to compare, but I guess to say yes, given what happened a few years ago.
Seriously.
Absolutely.
And he's won twice. He's running for a third term.
And he survived a recall.
Indeed. He won. He survived a recall 2 years later. He won again. And now he's up for the third time, which is essentially his fourth statewide race. But it's literally tied there. Now, Ohio is running 50-50. This is Richard Cordray versus Mike DeWine. DeWine beat Cordray for state attorney general 4 years ago. They're in a rematch. This is a far more Democratic year. And then, much to everybody's surprise, the issue in that race is different from the issues in most of the other races. The issue in Ohio is also focused on water, and it's focused on these algae blooms in Lake Erie. And Ohioans are just not getting clean water right now. I wonder if this issue of clean water is going to stretch across the Great Lakes, because we're seeing people talking about it in the race in Minnesota. We're seeing it in Illinois, which is going to be solidly Democratic this year. We're seeing it in Wisconsin and even in Pennsylvania. Governor Tom Wolf is a shoe-in for re-election there in Pennsylvania. But there's this consistent theme across these races of clean water. Do you think it's going to come down to that?
Well, I think people are clearly becoming much more aware of how much at risk we all are about, you know, with public water systems throughout the country. I mean, I think Flint really triggered a huge alarm bell around the country, and more people are becoming conscious of the horrible situation and how dangerous it is, not only for us, but very much for our kids. So, yeah, I think that the right to clean water is a definite issue that could be the focal point for several of these elections. What these guys are going to actually do about it, in my opinion, remains to be seen. You know, we'll see if when the Democrats, you know, assuming that the Democrats do win a lot of the seats, both in the state legislature as well as the governor's seat in Michigan, you know, there's like a huge a lot riding on both the mass civil litigation that's just sitting there languishing because the state has done everything in its power to, up till now, this litigation has been pending now for almost 4 years, and it's simply languishing because at every turn, the state of Michigan, through its dozens and dozens of privately retained corporation lawyers, have obstructed the ability to move that case forward, any of these cases forward. And it's been a very political, calculated move. And so when the power balance shifts to the Democrats, you know, we're kind of keeping our fingers crossed and holding our breath and hoping that they will be serious about wanting to do what's right and take the steps that are necessary both to compensate this community and also to ensure that the infrastructure is improvements that are necessary to stop allowing these toxins from getting into our systems, you know, making the repairs that are necessary, replacing the pipes that need to be replaced and so forth.
Indeed. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Detroit by Julie Hurwitz. She's a civil rights attorney and partner at the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James. You've been listening to Loud & Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud & Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear.
Ah.